Dr. Curtis Dobler is an international human rights lawyer who has represented governments, heads of state, and millions of refugees or displaced persons. He is also a professor who researches and teaches at a number of universities. He is constantly traveling between the US, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, and we finally caught up to him currently at the UN in New York. It's great to have you on the podcast, Dr. Dobler.
Nice to speak with you.
Now, the Middle East has been in crisis since time immemorial, but there seems to be a renewal of tensions given the Syrian war of intervention, the Israeli-Palestine crisis, and the latest Temple Mount incident, the Saudi-sponsored war in Yemen, and now fallout between the GCC countries and Qatar due to what some say is Qatar's pursuit of more independent policies and desire to work with Iran. For this first part of the interview, I wanted you, somebody with great authority on the subject and who has skin in the game, so to speak, who's on the ground, to give an overview of what you consider to be the main sources of chaos in the Middle East. Who is destroying the Middle East? Is it US-EU intervention, Russian meddling, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the struggle between Wahhabism and traditional Sunni Islam? What do you consider are the main driving forces behind the chaos and the human rights violations?
Well, I think it's probably all of those that you mentioned, and maybe a few more. The Middle East, as many parts of the world, but particularly perhaps the Middle East, because of its geopolitical status over the last at least 100 years, perhaps the most complex geopolitical status of anywhere on the globe. It's been subject to a lot of forces, and I would say mainly outside forces, that did not always produce good, in part because they weren't concerned with the interests of the people of the Middle East. If you look at the countries in the Middle East that have been destroyed, Syria, one of the most advanced countries in the Middle East, Iraq, a developed country, Libya, the richest country in Africa, a impoverished continent to a large extent, but the richest country in that continent, was destroyed. And all of those were destroyed by actions taken or promoted mainly by people outside, or countries, governments outside of the Middle East. So I think certainly there's a very strong element of outside meddling that has not contributed to the betterment and the development of the lives of the people in the Middle East. And I find that very unfortunate. This body where I'm in today, the United Nations headquarters, I think has made a half-hearted effort to try to address these issues. And I think it's right now in very grave danger of becoming a part of the problem, and actually a part of the problem which people will lose faith in it. If you remember, some of these problems were existing, in fact, many of them, but some of the more longer-standing ones were existing before the creation of the United Nations. For example, the situation in Palestine. That predates the United Nations by quite a few years, and it was on the agenda of the United Nations when the United Nations was created. And I think it's unfortunate that it is something that has not now been resolved to date. And the United Nations has put some time and energy into it, but they don't have a lot to show for that. So I think that these type of situations certainly indicate that there were a lot of outside forces at work, either promising solutions or creating problems in these areas that has not been very valuable. Having said that, though, you can't absolve the people in any country of some degree of responsibility for their own fate. Palestinians, as you know, right now, the biggest enemy of Palestinians is probably each other. Hamas and Fatah fighting against each other rather than Israel. In fact, they'd have a golden opportunity right now to show the injustice of what Israel is doing, but often that opportunity is handicapped by one side not wanting to show that the other side is being treated unfairly. And I think that's unfortunate. And one of the more recent examples that you mentioned is the example of Qatar, where the problem in Qatar, although I think it had a hand from outside, but still you can certainly not absolve the countries involved that are pressing against them. And I think in my view, I'm not hesitant to say, and I think a very unfair way, particularly, and I think that's shown mainly by the fact that one of the conditions that they want to impose on Qatar is the fact that they want to shut Al Jazeera, a media outlet. I can't imagine anywhere in the world, and a country that's not free or that is free, that they would accept a condition that they close a media outlet, even their own state media, much less than a more independent one. And I think that is something that the countries that are demanding that should be embarrassed of. But again, it's an example of how Middle Eastern countries are sort of feuding with each other.
And you mentioned the UN and how it seemed to be losing its legs or influence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and with the recent developments in the recent years? What's happening at the UN and the level of enforcement it has or that it's lost?
Well, as you know, there have been a lot of resolutions adopted, but very few of these resolutions have been implemented, at least when they don't have a strong country like the United States behind it. For example, the resolution taken against Iraq in August 1991 was implemented, but it was implemented more because of the will of one of the major powers than it was because of a commitment to a standard of the rule of law. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think that, in fact, is one of the biggest problems we have right now in the United Nations. The United Nations is a body, like any international organization, whose heart and soul is its mandate. And the mandate of the United Nations is the Charter of the United Nations. It's not a country that has a army and political, or that same type of political weight and monetary weight that a country has that it can throw around as political power. It is an international organization made up of a community of states in which the different states are technically sovereign equals, but at least have to balance different interests, and where it should be able to move forward on areas of consensus. And the area, bar none, that we have, that we call consensus, is international law, either customary international law or treaties. And it has not been very successful in implementing the rules that are laid down in those treaties. The right to self-determination is in the UN Charter. It's in the first article of two of the three instruments that make up the International Bill of Rights, two treaties, legally binding documents signed by each over 160 countries, or I should say ratified, so state parties of over 160 countries of the United Nations states. Yet still we have Western Sahara, where the International Court of Justice in 1974 said that these people have a right to self-determination. They have been given that right. Again, that's almost two Arab states fighting with each other. The Palestinian people that have been have the right to self-determination, had the right even before the creation of the United Nations, and have still not had that right acknowledged. And I think that these ongoing failures of the United Nations to ensure respect for the rule of law are eventually going to catch up with them, as they do with any government or any body that cannot enforce its own internal rules.
And you mentioned the right to self-determination. If we can go back then to Syria, what would you say regarding Syria and their right to making their own sovereign decisions and self-determination, as well as Russia's role? Because would you agree that Russia's participation in the war in Syria has been following the rule of law and international law, because they have been invited by President Assad to participate? What can you tell us about that?
I think Syria is a good case to look at how the rule of law should be implemented, because the rule of law provides that states should not use force against another state. It also provides, or international law, I should say, the rule of international law provides that one state should not use force against another state. It also provides, though, that a sovereign state is responsible for the security and the public order in its country. Now, we might not like a particular government, but that's not really somebody outside the country's interest to say they like or don't like a country. That's what non-interference is all about. It's the people in the country that decide on their government. That's what self-determination is all about. And in the case of Syria, I think that we violated both of those provisions, and that first of all, within the country, the people have, even during this war, elected the president of the country that is still the president. All right, you can argue if that was free or fair election, but that's a different argument. That's something that can be considered within the context of a sovereign country. But to provide resources to people, non-state actors who use force against a sovereign government, that is clearly outside the realm of international law. And within the realm of international law, since you asked the question about the comparison, is for a state to ask for assistance from another state to help it secure its own responsibilities towards its people, including keeping public order and maintaining security in the state. And in fact, if you look at what Russia has done in Syria, it's really been more productive for the people of Syria than what the outside community has been doing before and after Russia got involved in it. So it's really the state's decision and the people of that state's decision to choose a government that decides then how best to protect its people, maintain public order. And to ask another state to assist is possible. But when a state intervenes in the affairs of another country without being asked, we know very clearly since 1986, we've known that that is clearly illegal. That in 1986, the International Court of Justice, at the behest of a prestigious gentleman who just passed away, Mikhail Descoto Brockman, who was then the foreign minister of Nicaragua, they brought this question to the International Court of Justice in relation to the United States support of Contras in El Salvador that were intervening in Nicaragua. And the court unambiguously said it is illegal. So, you know, these are not issues that you can have so much debate about in terms of the principles of international law that are being contravened. And again, I think that leads back to your last question, that undermines the authority of a body like the United Nations when the rule of law has been determined, interpreted in a certain way, and then is not respected. And I think the United Nations should be doing more to do that. Instead, you've seen several of the bodies created by the United Nations looking at just criticizing the government of Syria instead of working towards a resolution that recognizes the responsibility of all sides.
And what are your thoughts on how the situation in Syria will resolve? Do you see it becoming another Iraq, or do you see things winding down and the Assad government regaining control again?
Well, I think the government, I don't think you call it the Assad government, I call it the Syrian government. I think the Syrian people have to decide who they want their leader to be now and in the future. They voted not so long ago, but they will have to do that again in a not too long time. And they will have to decide. But I think what is important for us is people looking at this as part of the international community is that we respect the sovereignty of Syria. And I think it would have been a very serious matter if, again, a outside intervention had succeeded in destroying essentially the sovereign integrity of a country. And I think Syria will make it through this now. I think it's not 100% yet, but I'm much more confident than a couple of years ago or even a year ago. I think that they're moving in the right direction. They still have strong responsibilities, and the government seems to recognize those. It has a responsibility to rebuild its country. It has a responsibility to give redress to people who have been injured there. It has a responsibility to respect the human rights of the people in Syria. And the government has never denied these responsibilities, and I think that's already a good starting point for a rebuilding process. But I hope that very soon we will start to consolidate some of the gains that have been made militarily there and turn them into political processes to start rebuilding Syria. Because as I said, Syria was one of the leading countries in the Middle East, one of the most developed countries in the Middle East. It translated more English or other language books to Arabic than every other country in the Middle East put together. So just in terms of knowledge and education, it had a tremendous impact. And really, I don't think the Middle East and the people there deserve to lose another sovereign state like that that has had such a strong impact in building the history of the globe.
And what can you say about the media and propaganda and the West? As you mentioned, that a lot of these things seem to be straightforward, documented and clear, yet we find in Europe and the West that they're still towing the same line and repeating many lies And it's still, what you're saying, that still doesn't seem to have broken through, or is it? How do you see the media and the involvement in all of this?
Although I'm an international lawyer now, I actually did my university degrees in journalism and worked for a few years as a journalist, so I am very sensitive to journalistic integrity, and I'm very troubled by what we see in today's particularly mainstream media. What I think is good is the proliferation of media. Even though I don't agree with everything people like Press TV and RTV say and Al Jazeera, I think it's very important we have this other media having a voice there. And I think that's good. And even programs like yours, I think, are very important. I'm not at all somebody who is against the proliferation of small media outlets. Sometimes they do the best reporting. Here at the United Nations, a little group called Inner City Press, which the reporter is Matthew Lee, is probably the best media outlet here, even though his budget is probably 1% of what some of the mainstream media's budget is for covering the United Nations. I think the media is very important, and we need to maintain the integrity of it to have it continue to have that importance. Otherwise, it just becomes advertising. And advertising is something that tries to just push people in a direction that the advertiser wants, and not to get them to really make up their own mind. News is supposed to give people information in a society of where people participate, and that's what we're trying to strive for. That is what it states, actually, in Article 25 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, that every individual has a right to participate in their own government. That means that they have a right to know what is happening in their government and to be able to contribute to, either by voting or by running for election or by even campaigning for others, in a knowledgeable form. When you're not knowledgeable, when you're being given things that are not true or that are biased, or you're not being told the whole story, then your participation is handicapped. And you can't participate to the extent that that right requires or that that right allows. And I think that's a very dangerous thing we have right now with the media. You know, we've had cases where the BBC, where American networks, CNN even, Fox News, have been caught falsifying news. And that is a very serious matter when you do that. As a journalist, I tell you, when I was studying journalism, someone who did that would not only be immediately fired, the news outlet would be possibly closed down for doing something like that. And I think that's something we need to, there needs to be much more attention to, and I don't think there is right now.
And just to summarize again, you could add anything else to it. You believe that a lot of foreign intervention has systemically been causing problems in the Middle East, as well as problems that predate the creation of the UN, as well as, you say, the responsibility of the individuals in the countries and the problems they have between themselves. And if you want to add anything to that, and then if you could mention what you think would be prudent measures that should be taken towards resolving some of these conflicts. You've mentioned the UN again. And the application of international law. We know that representatives like in the U.S., Tulsi Gabbard, have proposed bills such as the Stop Arming the Terrorists Act. What recommendations do you have for civil society, for regional organizations or international organizations or even states themselves?
Well, my recommendations as an international lawyer would probably be where I started, that really, we need to take more seriously respect for the rule of international law. And I don't say that just because I'm a lawyer. I say it for the same reason I mentioned at the beginning. It forms the lowest common denominator that we have agreed on in the international community. So it is something that we have already agreed on. It's not holding people to my moral or ethical standards. It's holding people to what they have agreed in solemn agreements to be the minimum standard that they need to coexist together peacefully. And I think that's extremely important. I think whether you're an NGO, whether you're a government, whether you're an intergovernmental organization whose heart and soul, as I mentioned, is based on international law, you need to ensure respect for the rule of law as a sine qua non for being able to progress further than that. If we can't ensure respect for the rule of international law, we're never going to be able to achieve development to the level of the SDGs that we talked about. We're never going to be able to live in a peaceful society. Having said that, I think we have made some progress on it. One of the things which I was surprised to hear, I'm here for the high-level political forum, which is the forum for the implementation of the SDGs, but it's mainly just a discussion forum. There's not really any credible implementation mechanism. But I was very surprised to hear it at the opening of this, when the Secretary General Guterres spoke, when the president of the ECOSOC spoke, when even Jeffrey Sachs, an American academic, gave a speech. None of them mentioned what I think is one of the most important instruments, a legal instrument that has the text now, has been adopted by the General Assembly, and it will be open for signature on the 20th of September of this year when the General Assembly's next session opens. And that's a text of the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, which would ban nuclear weapons around the world. The Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty is probably one of the most important steps that the United Nations has taken almost since its existence. And I think it will go into force when it is open for signature for states to start to join on the 20th of September of this year. But I was surprised to see it not mentioned by anybody during the high-level political forum, even though peace was mentioned as being a condition sine qua non for the accomplishment of the SDGs. No leader, including the Secretary General of the United Nations, who has said that peace is one of his priorities, mentioned the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty. And I think that is a example of how, if it is effective, the rule of law, and if it is respected because it is a instrument of international law, it could make a significant contribution to development as well as peace in the international community. And I think that will be these type of instruments, more so than things like the SDGs, which are not legally binding. The legally binding instruments will really be the litmus test of whether or not the United Nations still has relevance in today's world.
Indeed, the nuclear treaty is very important. In fact, in a few months, I'm moving to a country that harbors the principal Soviet nuclear test site, and I will be living not too far from it. So it'd be good to get rid of these weapons. And finally, for your final thoughts or comments. So, you see a future that is a bit brighter the way things are going, or darker?
Well, what I do see that I think is, for me, a little bit hopeful is some of the young people that I've seen, like yourself, that are trying to work for a better world. You know, I've worked with a lot of older people. I worked with Nelson Mandela, Ahmed Bembella, Ramsey Clark, Stokey Carmichael, people who were really the past generation. Now I'm becoming the past generation. But I'm somewhat fortunate as a professor. I work also with young people. I have to teach young people at universities. And I'm quite optimistic about many of the young people that I've seen. They have... not all of them, certainly, and I think, unfortunately, today, a lot of times it's difficult to be able to maintain that type of optimism with all the material pressures on you just to be able to survive. And remember, I teach in one of the poorest countries in the world, Sierra Leone, but I still see, even in Sierra Leone, people with the willingness and the intrinsic ability, particularly young people, to try to change the world for the better. And they understand, not all of them even have studied international law, but they understand a lot of the basic principles of international law. They understand that to have development, you need to have peace. You need to have respect for the sovereignty of your neighbor. And that is a good sign. I think a lot of them understand human rights. Even again, if they don't understand them in their legal context, they understand that people want to have health care, want to have education, want to have enough food, clean water, sanitation. All these are human rights. And I think that makes me optimistic. I think right now I'm in the stage that you are often in a generation. You know, it's always said that as you get older, you get more cynical about the world. And I think I'm maybe becoming a bit more cynical. But I do see the relief in that cynicism coming from the young people. And I hope, and I'll try to do all I can to empower them, because I think that I think they're sincere about trying to make this place better, not only for themselves, but for future generations. And that's one way, I think, that that's how the UN was established. It was established not thinking of just the people who were living after World War II. Most of them were not going to live much longer. But it was thinking about future generations and how we can keep this planet sustainable and livable for as long as possible. And it's good to see young people thinking about that, and I hope this generation will move more in that direction. My generation didn't do such a great job, but I'm more optimistic about the next generation.
Well, that's a good, hopeful, optimistic message to leave us with, and we thank you for your time and your work, and wish you the best for your work at the UN, for your teaching, and trying to save the world.
Just trying to do a little bit. And thank you very much, because I think your work is also tremendously important to try to cover issues that might not be covered fully in the mainstream media. So good luck with that. And thank you very much.